I've been looking for someone with a BBC accent. Your hire will start you this afternoon. Have you done any broadcasting in England?
No. I mean, apart from interviews and stuff like that. No, I'm looking to be hired in the States. I mean, I was once, when I was television critic of The Observer, I got a letter out of the blue from the arts editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, saying, "Will I come and be their television critic?" And offering me lots of dollars. I was very touched by that.
I think it would be better being a television critic in the United States. There's so much more to criticize here. Have so many more channels. I'm on a cable hookup here in Manhattan. We have 64 channels.
Mm. But there are probably only 62 that you would want to write joined-up criticism about, aren't there?
Actually, there's only one channel I watch. It's called American Movie Classics.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Old movies from the 30s and 40s, and
yes.
Uncut, you know. And they're,
yes.
They're really, they're fun to watch. It was another world, a real world of make-believe. I mean, movies seem to be realistic today. But these movies you saw from Hollywood in the 30s and 40s, filmed on a back lot.
Yes.
The sets don't even look real, you know. Just a fantasy world that doesn't exist anymore.
But which probably seemed much more real than we imagine now, then, don't you think? Don't you think all those films with painted backcloths and stuff like that, people thought that it was quite close to reality, and now it looks absurd?
I believe you're right, and I think one of the reasons I'm enjoying watching some of these old films is that I saw some of them when I was a child in the theater, and of course I was very moved by them and frightened by them and amused by them. But they're not as good. I mean, it's nostalgic to watch them, but they're not as good today as they were when I was a kid. It's like the old, you still have some radio drama in London, I believe. There's very little in the United States, but when I was a kid, I listened to the radio, and we had these afternoon shows. Jack Armstrong, Captain Midnight, Sky King, Hop Harrigan. They're 15-minute adventure shows for kids after school. And I used to listen to them avidly as a kid. And a lot of them are available on tape today, and they don't make sense. You know, the acting is terrible. The plots are... They're comic strips for the air.
Yes. Yes, they're re-showing on British television at the moment. They're re-showing The Lone Ranger, which is one of the... Part of my staple diet as a kid. I looked forward to it every week. And then it just completely disappeared. And I remember when I was a television critic, there was a lawsuit about Clayton Moore, who played the Lone Ranger over here in the States,
yes.
About whether or not he had the right to wear his mask and things like that. And
I believe he was making appearances in shopping centers.
Yes.
He was dressed as the Lone Ranger, and it was questionable whether he had the rights.
Whether he had, yes, exactly. it was sort of terribly sad, and I remember writing a special column about it, saying, and it was headlined, "Justice for the Lone Ranger," which was a sort of sentimental dues-paying to my childhood. But now they're re-showing them, and it's very odd to go around to a friend who has small children and a huge television screen, much bigger than the children themselves. And here come the Lone Ranger and Tonto riding past a sort of plastic cactus and off into the desert. And I'm afraid the magic doesn't work anymore.
Of course, you are blessed with having Dennis Potter there, wonderful television material. I mean, made for television and working so well for television. We have nothing equivalent to Dennis Potter's work here.
Yes, there's still a very vibrant tradition of television drama and sort of classic adaptations of books and plays and things like that, which I think you get quite a lot of on, is it Masterpiece Theatre or... Some such.
Oh, yes, Masterpiece Theatre. Yes. We this past week they had a two-part series with Denholm Elliott as Smiley. I can't remember the title, but
yes.
it was a John Le Carré mystery
yes.
novel set in a public school in, I believe, the south of England somewhere.
A Murder of Quality?
I believe that was the title, yes.
Yes.
It was very well done. Very nicely done, and introduced, of course, by Alistair Cook. Well, we're here to talk about you and talk about your new book, Talking It Over, and A book which I read with a terrific amount of amusement. I had, however, to run to the dictionary to get the definition for crepuscular. Is that how you pronounce it?
Crepuscular, yes.
And that was a word that was not familiar to me, but one of your characters,
Oliver,
used that quite frequently. Maybe you can explain that word and how it's used in the book.
Well, crepuscular comes from the French crepuscule for dusk, so it means sort of gloomy. Oliver is one of the three central characters in my novel, and he's the one who is most gifted with words. You could say he's over-gifted because he uses words as a sort of protective screen, as a sort of flashing cape that he waves in the reader's face. And the reader will pick up pretty quickly the idea that Oliver is keen on this word crepuscular. He uses it. It's the most commonly used difficult word in the early part of the book. And at a certain point, Oliver falls in love, and he decides, as people do on these occasions, that he's going to clean out his life. He's going to start from scratch. He's going to change his way of doing things. He's going to stop smoking. He's going to clean up his act. He's going to stop camping around. And he says, I'm going to stop using the word crepuscular. And he does, for a bit. And then about 50 pages on, and this is sort of a slight game with the reader, he uses it again. And I expect the reader at that stage to say, either, wow, I don't know what's happened, either Julian Barnes has made a mistake, or that Oliver hasn't stuck to his promise. And then about 20 pages on, he uses it again. Only this time he says, yes, oh, and by the way, yes, I do know I've used the word crepuscular again. But I'm going to go on, so there. And this is partly an indication that his attempt to clean up his act is not working, that he's going to go on being the same old Oliver all the way through the book.
You had fun with Oliver, especially, I think, didn't you?
I had fun with Oliver, dangerous fun at times, in that there's often one character in a book who is the easiest to write and who, therefore, you have to rein in. You mustn't run away with the book.
Oliver is a character always at the edge, it seemed to me, at least at the beginning until the second wedding.
Yes, that's right. I mean, he's though he presents himself as tremendously in control and knowing what's what and organizing his life. I mean, he's in fact a mess. He's unraveling all the time. He's deeply neurotic, and he puts on this great act to cover up the fact that basically he hasn't got much of a job. Sometimes he hasn't got a job at all because he's been sacked, and he's possibly been sacked. We're not sure, for sexual harassment. And that his emotional life consists of stealing his wife's his best friend's wife. So there's not much to be proud of, which is all the more reason why he puts on this sort of verbal display.
Well, talking it over, of course, is the interaction of three characters: Oliver, of course, his best friend Stuart, and Gillian, who is the woman in the center. One thing that struck me as I read the book through the end is that there is a real role reversal. Oliver is at the beginning, of course, in the first half of the book, always the outsider looking in. By the end of the book, it's Stuart who is the outsider looking in.
Yes, and this is actually crystallized in a couple of scenes where Oliver, in order to be near his beloved Gillian when she's still married to Stuart, hires a room in the same street as them and sort of turns out the light and sits there at the window watching them come back from where they've been in the evening, watching Gillian come back from shopping, and uses this as a means of pursuing her. Rings her up from the other side of the road, declares his love down the telephone and so on. And then there's a reversal of this scene right at the end, by which time Gillian and Oliver are married, they're living in France, and Stuart comes in order to make his life whole in some way, in order to finally purge himself of the terrible things that have happened to him. And he hires a hotel room opposite their house in this little French village, and thinks he's going to confront them, but because of something he sees, I won't give the plot away entirely, because of something he sees, he's unable to come out and confront them. And so he stays at his hotel window and looks and looks. And that's, you know, that's one of the sort of key images of the book.
Of course, it's Gillian who resolves the issue, but I don't believe we're quite certain how the issue is ultimately resolved, are we? You kind of left us up in the air to a degree.
Well, I think we can be quite clear. I mean, this is a book in which the characters talk at you, the reader, all the way through, and they give you different versions of what's happening. And you're, as a reader, meant to have a sort of active role in the book in making decisions about whose side you're on, who's telling the truth, and so on. By the time you get to the ending, I think it's also partly a matter of your own judgment as a reader, what you think has happened to each of the characters and how they're going to be from there on in. I think it's fairly clear that Stuart, from what has happened in the final scene, which I don't want to talk about, but it's a final dramatic scene, has probably come out of what he's gone through damaged but able to continue. I think he's finally purged of the whole business. The future for Gillian and Oliver is more doubtful because of what's happened at the end of the book. My own guess is that they will continue, and that Gillian, who is rather good at sorting things out and making them work, having come across at the start of the book as rather quiet, reasonable creature, she's actually the strongest of the three characters by the end of the book, that she'll be able to sort of bend Oliver to her will.
That's my version. The feeling of, although you didn't take it past that point, I got the feeling that Gillian, you call her, while she, as you say, is strong, she was also a cipher in some respects, flattered by Oliver's attention, and ultimately swayed to him. But I got the impression toward the end that she was about to swing back to Stuart, because she could be flattered, knowing that Stuart is in that village across the street watching her, that she could easily be swayed to go back there, that her own life is not quite resolved, that she could go either way.
Well, I'm glad. I mean, I'm glad that this is another interpretation, because this is a book in which, you know, the author isn't there. I mean, I wrote it, of course, but there's no controlling authorial voice. There's no one telling you what's what. And so I'm quite happy to leave the end open to different interpretations. And if you felt that Gillian was coming around to Stuart, I mean, that's equally valid, it seems to me. I mean, that's not how I read it, but I'm quite happy. I don't find that a sort of disappointing ambiguity in my book.
Well, that's the way life is, isn't it?
Well, exactly.
All of our interactions are open to interpretation.
Yes, yes. And
makes things very complicated.
Well, so is life. Yes, I do.
Now, talking it over is your sixth novel?
Sixth, yes.
Sixth novel.
Yes.
But you also write mystery novels, I understand, under a pseudonym.
I have, yes. I've written four of them under the pseudonym Dan Kavanagh. I started the same year that I published my first novel under my own name. But I haven't written one for about 4 or 5 years, and my communications with Dan are a bit sort of erratic. You know, he's not a public figure, he doesn't give interviews at all. So I think last I talked to him, he said he was thinking of writing a couple more, but he's lazier than I am.
Have they been published in the United States?
Yes, three of the four have. The fourth, the one that wasn't published, was all about English soccer. So I guess they thought it wouldn't travel.
The character, I understand, Duffy, is kind of an unusual hero. Tell me about him.
Well, he's, I think, the only bisexual detective in the world, though doubtless people will immediately write in and point out ones that are there already. I haven't come across another one.
I believe a writer named Joseph Hansen.
I think he's homosexual, I think at the time this was the first to have a bisexual investigator, and it was one of those decisions that you make sort of quite easily at the start of writing a series of books, which then later come back to haunt you. It was the first one is set in the sort of sex industry in Soho in London, And as it's sort of full of moral and legal ambiguity, I thought that it would be quite a useful trick to have a hero with a sexual ambiguity, and that this would sort of echo various things that were going on in the book. So then I wrote another one, and then I started writing the third one, at which time the very first sort of echoes of the whole AIDS crisis were beginning to be heard, but no one sort of knew quite what it was or took it seriously. And then by the time I was writing the fourth, I realized that, of course, you know, without intending, I'd sort of, you know, laid up trouble for my hero. This is one of the talking about it on a purely technical level, this is one of the troubles of having running characters from book to book. You make decisions early on which will have huge repercussions later. You do something idly, like you say that Duffy's very neurotic, and he's scared of flying. And there's the second one, he goes to Heathrow and investigates there, and every time he sort of an airplane lands, he sort of winces, and he's never flown anywhere. And then after I'd established that as a given in the series, you know, all of a sudden I realised I wanted him to go to Spain. I wanted him to go to what we call the Costa del Crime, where lots of British hoods are on the run. And I can't, you know, I can only get him there over land now. It's going to take a long time to get him there. I wanted to, at one point I thought it'd be quite nice to land him in New York, but I think that's absolutely out of the question. I think the overland route to New York is too complicated.
Should we say serious novels as opposed to detective novels? They're quite unusual. You certainly cannot be compared, for example, to Jeffrey Archer, who
thank you.
Jeffrey's very proud of his work, but of course he's a man who deals primarily with plot and not very much with character or with words.
Yes, I mean I don't think. I'm glad you're not comparing me with Jeffrey Archer, is all I can say. I mean, I wouldn't. There's only one comparison I'd like, and that's as if I had the sales that he had.
Well, I would more closely compare you with Martin Amis, however, who has a similar love for developing character and playing with the language and the sort of thing.
Yes, I mean, I'm very drawn to writers who. It seems to me odd to be a writer and not to be fascinated by language, by the positioning of every word. It's like being a painter and not wanting to use a brush, but wanting to use a sort of spray can. And sometimes you can get sort of decent pictures out of a spray can. And sometimes you can get good novels. You can't get good novels out of careless use of language. You can often get good novels out of plain use of language. That can be very effective. But I think I'm one of those writers who likes to explore, you know, the whole range of colours, the whole range of brushes, and the whole length of the dictionary.
Now, Julian, your big hit up till now, at least, was Flaubert's Parrot. That was kind of a surprise smash for you, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, completely. When I wrote it, I had no expectations that it would sell any more copies than my first two novels, which had sold about 3,000 in Britain and hadn't been translated. And then Flaubert's Parrot came along and has up to now been translated into, I think, 24 languages and has sold, you know, I don't know, 100 times more than the other ones. And that was my breakthrough book. That's the book that established my name. I mean, the only lesson I draw from it is that the best way of writing a successful book is to write what you have to, what you most passionately want to, rather than what you expect will produce success. This is true, I think, in the area of the literary novel anyway. I don't think it's probably, I'm sure that there are formulas you can follow in you know, commercial fiction or genre fiction, but I think in the general area of the literary novel, you can't sort of guess at what will go down, that what communicates itself is is the writer's passion for the theme, and it has to be well done, you know.
Literary novels are hard to get published, and many literary writers put in their dues. They struggle for years and years, and sometimes they gradually build. It does happen.
Yes, I mean, I think I'm that sort of... I mean, though Flaubert's Parrot did make a big jump from my two previous books, I think I am the sort of writer whose work gets spread slowly, mainly by word of mouth. I mean, that's... When I talk to readers, they very rarely say, I read a review in the papers and decided to buy it. What they tend to say, my friend Janie gave me this book and insisted that I read it. And that's the most gratifying thing of all for a writer, to hear something like that, that one of your books was pressed on someone. And sometimes they say, you know, well, I heard about it. I didn't think I wanted to read it, but my friend Jim insisted. And that's nice, too.
You do have an interest in France, don't you? And it reappears in Talking It Over, where...
Yes.
...the couple settle in, I guess, the northern part of France, in a little village.
Yes. My father was a French teacher, and I went to France on sort of family holidays from the age of 12 or something like that. I studied French at Oxford. And there's always seems to be a point in my books where the characters go to France. I mean, for us, it's where the exotic begins. I mean, it's different for the French. The French can look in four different directions and see, you know, the Germans, the Italians, the Spanish, and us. And so we're much less important to them. But as we look out, we see, you know, ocean in three directions, and France on the other side. So we, the British, concentrate much more on France, which is why it's both the most loved and the most loathed country among the English.
Americans have this loathing of the French too, but we go there all the time.
Yes, yes.
They treat us rudely sometimes. Although I've been in France and in Paris, I never had... any major problems there? They were all right.
Well, yes. I mean, I think Paris is different from provinces. I love going to the French provinces, and I always find them extremely courteous, and themselves, and not easily impressible, but very good mannered. Paris is snootier. And even though I got good French, what the French love to do is to correct your French. I think the height of this came for me once when I was trying to buy a bun in a cafe, and the waiter was, it was at the time of a great immigration from, I think, Vietnam or Cambodia, and this guy had obviously just come off a boat. And I said a very straightforward sentence with nothing grammatically wrong in it, asking for a cup of tea, and he corrected my French in broken French. So he'd obviously picked this up very early on, that if you were to be a Frenchman, this is what you had to do. You had to correct foreigners. It was very funny, purely comic to me.
I was in Paris a few years ago, and I wanted to bring back something for my mother. She liked a perfume. I think it was called Fabergé. And they made powder and as well as oils and this sort of thing. At any rate, I was in a major department store in Paris, and I saw some Fabergé, and I said, well, I'll take that back to my mother. So I bought it, I paid for it, and as I sat waiting for my wife to return from the restroom, I looked at the box, and on the side it said, manufactured in New Jersey. And I said, I can't go all the way to Paris and bring back a bottle of Fabergé that's made in New Jersey. So I went to the cashier, and I didn't speak French well enough to try to make myself clear. She finally brought the manager. I wanted my money back.
Yes.
She finally got the manager, who didn't speak English very well, but he finally understood what I was trying to say and burst into laughter. I exchanged it, I think, for something made in France.
Yes, getting harder to do that.
Well, back to you. I understand in reading some of the publicity material that Paul has prepared that you worked on the Oxford English Dictionary.
Yes, that's right. That was my first job after university. Well, it was about the only job I was offered. That's why I took it. The only other job. I was unemployed for about 9 months and was offered at the end of it two jobs, one as a tax inspector and one as a lexicographer. And I took the latter. I was there for 3 years, and it involved updating the great Oxford English Dictionary, which had really ceased in 1933 when they did a supplement. So it was looking at the last 50 years of the development of the English language, looking at the new words that had come in, the new meanings for the old words, and finding examples of usage, trying to find the first usage of new words as far as that was possible, writing definitions, etymologies. I only did it, you know, this is a continuing project which has only just come to completion and had been going on for about 10 years when I joined it. So I can only see evidence of my presence there in, I think, the letters C to G.
how do you do it exactly? Are you assigned a word and you're say, are you told to analyze it and update it? And
well,
how does it work?
It works in that there's an enormous reading program to begin with, in which general and specialized readers go through books published since the first dictionary came out. And if they find a word or a usage which isn't in the original Oxford English Dictionary, they note it down on a little slip of paper, the head word at the top left-hand corner, and then the quotation from the book illustrating its usage. This then goes into a huge file of these quotations. There were millions of them by the time I got there. It took up a couple of rooms. And the editor would go there, and he would sort out maybe 200 of these quotation slips. And he'd take out the ones which were scientific or mathematical or botanical. He'd give them to specialists. And then people like me would be left with the rump of general vocabulary. And so you'd be given this raw material of 100 pieces of paper with illustrations of a particular usage or word. And first of all, you'd have to make a decision on whether it qualified for entry into the dictionary. I mean, your decisions would always be looked at by a higher authority at a later stage, but you were the preliminary decider. And you would throw some out if they were sort of, very, very ephemeral slang terms, which had been there for 6 months in the music press or something like that, and then gone out. You'd think there's no point recording those in the dictionary. And then you would concentrate you would divide these 100 or so slips up into individual entries. And then if you got a word that you thought had probably come into existence earlier than the first quotation that you had for it, you would try and antedate it. You would try and find an earlier or preferably the first use of this word. So, for instance, you would have an ice hockey term. You would go off to the Bodleian Library in Oxford, which is one of the great copyright libraries in Britain, and you would have official entry into the stacks underground, and you would go down there and you would find lined up all the books on ice hockey published in England from the beginning to modern times, and you would work your way back through these looking for the point at which this term occurred first. And then if you had some indication that there was that this word had been invented by someone or that there was an earlier reference to a newspaper article or something, you'd track that back. So and at a certain point you had to decide that you were wasting too much time not getting it. I mean, one of my first defeats, I remember, was on the word, I was given the word germy, G-E-R-M-Y. There was a sort of Dylan Thomas quote from one of his letters about something like every lovely looking apple's wormy and even the nicest women are germy, something like that. Then there was one other quote, and I knew that germy, comma, of or pertaining to a germ, semicolon, dirty, that would be the sort of definition you would write, must have existed before Dylan Thomas used it. And I sort of spent days trying to find an earlier use of this.
This was not the kind of job you had to take home with you at night.
Well, no, you couldn't, because you couldn't take home the Bodleian Library, fortunately. Though occasionally I would find things in my own reading.
The things picked up later for you in terms of your work. I understand that you were a restaurant critic for a while.
Yes, that's right. After I left the dictionary, I trained as a lawyer for a bit and started as a freelance journalist. And then I at one point I was wrote a sort of column on a literary magazine, and then before I became a television critic, I was a restaurant critic, which was jolly good because it meant you could be sure of eating well.
Hope you had a good expense account.
Well, the deal was that I had 3 meals a month for 2 people, and I thought this was jolly good, and you got a small fee, but mainly it was, you know, your expenses. And I did go over the edge a bit after sort of third or fourth month. And I got a message from the editor of the magazine I was working for, saying, we have decided, I was writing under the pseudonym of Basil Seal. I got this message saying, we have decided that Basil Seal will next month investigate school food. And they sent me off to a couple of prep schools where I had to eat baked beans on white bread at 11:30 in the morning. This is what the kids liked.
Well, high school food is terrible food. I remember when I was in school, I think the key food that we were offered was something you probably don't get in England, but it's called a sloppy joe. Have you ever heard of it?
No, a sloppy joe is a sort of cardigan or something you wear in England.
Well, a sloppy joe here is it's a way of making ground hamburger go a lot further. Instead of making it into a patty, they make it into kind of casserole,
yes,
you know, and with tomatoes and this sort of thing, and then it's rather runny, and then they can just slap it on a bun.
Oh, sounds disgusting.
It was.
Yeah.
It was. Well, back to you. I understand that you are. Oh, before I ask that, somewhere along the line you began to write seriously and to begin to create a novel. Tell me about your first published work and how that came about.
My first published fictional work was a ghost story. There was a ghost story competition run by the Times newspaper, and the winners were to be published in book form by Jonathan Cape, the publishers, and the prize was £50 for, well, I think, world rights for the rest of your life. And I wrote one, and it was one of the 12 or 13 winners. And part of the deal was that you had to show your first completed work of fiction to the publishers, which I did about 5 years later. I had already been working on the novel, which took me a, you know, disgustingly long time, partly because I had very little confidence in what I was doing, didn't know what I was doing, didn't know whether anyone would be interested in what I wrote. Took me about 8 years, 9 years. And that came out, Metroland, that came out when I was 34. So I was a late starter.
You also have been writing for The New Yorker, haven't you?
I have in the last 2 years, yes. They came over, Bob Gottlieb, the editor, came over and was scouting for a London correspondent, and he came very cannily, came and had lunch and sought my opinion, and after describing the job, I said, well, I can think of somebody who could do it, me. And he said, well, I thought you might say that.
So what messages do you send to us from England?
Well, I have a generous brief. I'm allowed to follow where my interests go, and it's fascinating for me writing for a foreign audience who perfectly understands the language. I mean, usually you're writing at a foreign audience who knows a certain amount about Britain very well, but then there are lots of areas which I have to explain, you know, from the ground floor up. So, you know, an American audience would know about Margaret Thatcher, would know quite a lot about Margaret Thatcher, but the other members of her cabinet would be just completely shadowy figures. So partly that's of interest to me, re-examining my own country to explain it to an American audience. I'm allowed to write about politics, culture, society, whatever takes my fancy, really. I started last year, and I've done about 4 or 5 pieces so far. But, I mean, things like the downfall of Margaret Thatcher. Yeah, it was a great dramatic event in British political and social life. And so I did a sort of very long piece on that. And I think the next piece I'm going to do is about, you know, we've now had a year of John Major. I think he's probably not a figure who looms very large in the American consciousness at the moment.
Why don't you do something on Jeffrey Archer?
Well, let me say only that Jeffrey Archer does a lot for Jeffrey Archer by himself.
Yeah, I think he can handle his own publicity.
He doesn't need my assistance.
How important is the United States to you and other writers in England?
Well, it looms very large. We are very conscious of your writers and of the fact, you know, the challenging and rivalrous fact that you're writing in the same language. I think British writers are quite envious of the ambition of American writers. I think they're envious also of the fact that you live in a much more dramatic society than we do, and therefore that gives the writer more possibilities. You know, unless you're an Englishman and decides to write American novels, you don't have, if you're writing public novels, that is, you don't have such exciting raw material. You know, you can't write a novel about the assassination of Kennedy. You might write a novel about, you know, a cabinet minister having a duodenal ulcer. That would be a dramatic event in British public life. So your raw material we envy. Well, I think the size of your novels, to a certain extent. I mean, the British are traditionally handicapped by a fear of size, I think. Since, I mean, you know, Dickens obviously is, and the 19th century novels are different, but lately, I don't think British novelists have thought, I'm going to go out and seize the whole world and take it in.
Well, I can tell you that the size of the American novels has gotten completely out of hand. I've been urging Knopf and other publishers to limit their books to 200 pages or less. Since I have to read three or four books a week, that's very helpful to me. I just was reading Norman Mailer's latest novel, 1,300 pages. 1,300 pages.
Mm.
Just, and it's not even finished.
Mm. Yes. Well, I mean, it does, you know, it's like a painter who takes a very large canvas. I mean, if it doesn't work, then he's in much bigger trouble than if he takes a small canvas and it doesn't work, it seems to me.
Well, I
haven't read the mailer, so I haven't.
I was talking to Brian Moore recently, and he was telling me that his novels are getting shorter and shorter and much more gem-like.
They are. The last two or three have been, yes. The last big one was Black Robe, which I thought was a wonderful novel, set among the Canadian Indians and with the Jesuits. I mean, I can't speak for, you know, the commonwealth of British novelists, but I think my generation of British novelists is much more open generally to foreign writing, whether it be European or American. I think that with some of the previous generations of novelists there's been a certain snobbery about the idea that anyone who uses English and lives across the water could possibly, you know, write joined-up sentences. You know, a writer like Kingsley Amis sort of made a career out of saying that John D. MacDonald is a 10 times better writer than Saul Bellow and things like that, thereby diminishing them both. I don't think that's that line cuts much ice with my generation of writers. And it's interesting, this thing of having, when I go to Europe, I'm asked often why the British don't translate European writers very quickly, and why a lot of European writers are not as well known as they think they should be. The answer is partly that it's there's still some insularity, but it's also that we have this tremendous advantage over the French and the Germans and the Italians of having an exotic literature in our own language, because, you know, American literature is tremendously exotic to us, as is Australian or Indian or West Indian fiction, and that's a great luxury in a reading life, it seems to me.
Well, Julian Barnes, we're out of time. Talking it over is a very amusing and also a very moving book. It was wonderful having the chance to read it, and delightful having the chance to talk to you, and I thank you very, very much for stopping in and chatting with us.
Thank you. I'm sorry the book is just over 200 pages.